All right, the next matter we have on this morning is docket number 75889, Klon v. Valley Federal Credit Union. And counsel, are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and Ms. Shanks, would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll reserve 3 minutes.
All right, very good. Then you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Cherie Shanks. I'm here today on behalf of Appellant Daniel P. Klon, Sr. This appeal arises from a motion, from an order granting a motion to dismiss and from a subsequent order granting a motion for attorney's fees. Should this court rule Mr. Klon's favor on the first motion, it need not reach, on the first order, it need not reach the second consolidated appeal issue regarding the attorney's fees. While unclear from the order actually entered by the court as to the basis for its reasoning and dismiss, Respondent Valley Federal Credit Union raised 4 primary arguments in support of its motion to dismiss my client's complaint that was filed in December of 2017. The first argument that Valley Federal Credit Union raised was that Mr. Klon's claims are precluded under the doctrines of res judicata, claim preclusion and issue preclusion. And its argument in that regard is based on the fact that there was a prior lawsuit between my client and respondent which involved credit reporting. My client's current lawsuit, for context with this court, is based upon his allegations that Valley Federal Credit Union has been incorrectly stating to credit reporting agencies that his bank account was involved in a bankruptcy with a negative history. However, res judicata cannot apply to this case because the reporting at issue are 2 different types of reporting. The reporting which my client has brought this lawsuit on did not occur until after resolution of the prior action. In the prior action, Mr. Klon sued Valley Federal Credit Union on allegations that Valley Federal Credit Union had improperly closed his bank accounts. My client was a former victim of identity theft, something he's still dealing with today. And after multiple suspicious activities occurred on Mr. Klon's bank accounts with Valley Federal Credit Union, Valley Federal Credit Union closed his accounts, took the money from his savings account to pay off a credit card, and then reported that card as closed to credit reporting agencies, which is what banks do. When banks close your credit card account, they report those closures to Experian, Equifax. That's the standard reporting. Klon sued Valley Federal Credit Union not because it had reported his accounts as closed. His accounts were closed. That was an accurate statement. But because he believed that Valley Federal Credit Union should not have closed his accounts in the first place. Mr. Klon ultimately wound up filing bankruptcy. The claims against his claims against Valley Federal Credit Union became a claim of the bankrupt estate. And in 2014, Valley Federal Credit Union, Klon, and his trustee bankruptcy settled the allegations regarding Valley Federal Credit Union's improper closure of Klon's bank accounts. Then after, in around March of 2016, Mr. Klon discovered that Valley Federal Credit Union was now reporting his card as having been involved in bankruptcy with a negative history. Because reporting is involved in both cases, Valley Federal Credit Union has taken the stance that this therefore precludes Mr. Klon's claims as a matter of claim preclusion and issue preclusion. But it's different reporting, and the reporting at issue in this case occurred after settlement of the bankruptcy claims and the prior action. Nevada law under Roundhill and the more recent case, which Justice Stiglitz recently authored, of Rock Springs versus Raritan, has long established that a subsequently occurring event arising out of similar transactions not necessarily mean the event is precluded if it could not have been brought at the time of the prior claim. For example, in Rock Springs, there was a previous lawsuit between the parties involving whether...
Can I interrupt you just a second? Jason, there's some terrible feedback. Is there a mic that's not muted, or do you understand? I'm having trouble hearing you, Ms. Shanks. There's a lot of feedback on our end.
If you could, like, move a little bit closer, maybe.
Okay. Is this better?
Huh. Say, go ahead and begin again and come a little closer and We'll see if we can figure out what this is.
Okay. Is this better?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So Nevada law has long established that claim preclusion does not apply to subsequently occurring events arising out of the same transaction or a continuation of that transaction. The recent Rock Springs case demonstrates an issue with that. In the first Rock Springs lawsuit, the Rock Springs landowner sued because they claimed that their neighbor's masonry, I think it was a masonry wall, was negatively impacting their retaining wall. And their retaining wall was in a state of disarray as a result. They sued for damages. That lawsuit ended. They remained neighbors. The land was sold. New party came in. And then Rock Springs wall deteriorated to the part where to the point where it believed it needed to remove it. And so it again brought a lawsuit seeking to adjudicate its rights to remove that wall in light of the ongoing disputes that it had with its neighbors. This court held that that's not subject to claim preclusion, even though it involves the same transaction or here, the same wall. The wall wasn't deteriorated to a point where Rock Springs was contemplating moving it until after the first lawsuit concluded. So the claim could not have been brought at the time of the first lawsuit. It was a subsequently occurring event arising out of the same transaction. This has been part of Nevada law for years, ever since the Roundhill case. And in this case, Mr. Klon could not have brought his claims against Valley Federal Credit Union for reporting his card as being included in a bankruptcy with a negative history. Because when Mr. Klon sued Valley Federal Credit Union in 2013, there was no bankruptcy. There was also no negative history. His card had been paid off. So his claims did not arise until after, because Valley Federal Credit Union could not, as a matter of law, have reported the card of being involved in a bankruptcy until after the bankruptcy was done, and the bankruptcy concluded with the settlement agreement as to Mr. Klon's claims against Valley Federal Credit Union. So there is just simply no basis in the record before this court to find that the district court properly held that claim or issue preclusion applies. The regarding claim preclusion, which I've touched on greatly, the claim could not have been asserted. It did not exist. Regarding issue preclusion, because the claim didn't exist, neither did the issue. And that means the issue wasn't actually litigated. The parties were not discussing whether or not Valley Federal Credit Union could report Mr. Klon's card has been involved in a bankruptcy with a negative history at the time. They were fighting over whether or not Valley Federal Credit Union owed Klon damages for improperly closing his accounts. Their claim and issue preclusion on the record before the district court were not an option for the district court to grant Valley Federal Credit Union's motion to dismiss. The second argument that Valley Federal Credit Union raised was a court and satisfaction. And again, because it is a summary order, there are some procedural issues that I'm going to assume for the purposes of this argument would allow this court and would have allowed the district court to consider the settlement agreement in the bankruptcy. I believe, and Mr. Richmond can correct me if I am wrong, that a motion for judicial notice was filed in conjunction with their motion to dismiss, asking the court to take judicial notice of the bankruptcy settlement agreement. But irrespective of whether that bankruptcy settlement agreement was properly considered by the district court or not on a motion to dismiss, it's clear that it can't qualify as an accord and satisfaction. The provision that Valley Federal Credit Union relies on does not speak about future reporting conduct. It's very silent as to that point. And Nevada law under Pierce versus Lading and Walden versus Backus has made it clear that if you are going to hold a contract to be an accord and satisfaction of a subsequently occurring claim, there must be a clear meeting of the minds that you intended to waive that claim. And there is no meeting of the minds here in this case. In fact, if you look at that language in its entirety, and it is on page 77 of the Record on Appeal, it specifically quotes the Montana statute. And the Montana statute says, the parties agree to waive any claims that they have existing at the time of the execution of this release. As of the date of the release, Valley Federal Credit Union could not have been reporting Mr. Klon's card has been involved in bankruptcy with a negative history. Therefore, the claim did not exist at the time of the execution of the release. Because there's not a clear meaning of the minds here, there cannot be an accord and satisfaction. The same goes with release. There's been some argument about the release and what can you release. And Nevada law is, again, it's very similar analysis as to accord and satisfaction, that releasing future tort claims have to be specifically stated. It's against the public policy of this state to allow someone to hand you a piece of paper and let you waive your right to tort claims indefinitely into the future. And Mr. Kwan's claims arise in tort and statute in this case, slander, negligence, and a violation of Nevada's deceptive trade practice. Again, there's nothing in the language of this release that indicates a clear intent that Mr. Kwan would waive any right to allow Valley Federal Credit Union to continue inaccurately reporting the status of his card, or to now inaccurately report the status of his card. A third ground on which Valley Federal Credit Union moved for dismissal.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. So are there any of the new claims that you think are based in whole or in part upon the prior, or is it all new conduct?
I believe, Your Honor, that it's all new conduct. In the first case, Mr. Kwan was upset that his accounts had been closed. The money in the accounts he was going to use to pay property taxes, he couldn't pay his property taxes. When the credit agencies got wind that his accounts had been closed by Valley Federal Credit Union, another banking institution closed the business accounts, and it created a history of issues with him professionally, which wound up resulting in the bankruptcy. In this case, those have been resolved. He's moved on from the identity theft. He's moved on from Valley Federal Credit Union, but he is trying to reestablish new bank accounts and new banking relationships. And when you have a statement that a credit account was involved in bankruptcy with a negative history, that has harmed his ability to do that.
I'm sorry, did that credit report history exist at the time they settled the bankruptcy piece? At the time they settled the earlier lawsuit, was that information, negative information, even if it's erroneous negative information, already at the credit bureau? So is the complaint of Mr. Kwan that they just left it there and didn't fix it? Or is after the first settlement, did they send a new letter to the credit bureau or give new misinformation?
So Mr. Kwan alleged this is new information. This is new. This was happening after the bankruptcy. In reality, as to whether that was happening before, I don't know. But there's nothing in the record to indicate that it was, and it was a motion to dismiss. So the district court similarly did not have anything in its record demonstrating that it had existed prior to the date when Mr.
Kwan was. Okay, thank you.
With that, I believe, I can't tell.
Do you want to reserve
remotely? You're at 2:49, and so I think you want to reserve 3 minutes, so we'll reserve the rest.
Yes. Okay, well, I'll wrap up my final argument, if that is all right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Regarding limitations, Valley Federal Credit Union raised statute of limitations as a defense, and statute of limitations is only a basis for dismissal if it's apparent from the face of the complaint. There was nothing that Mr. Kwan alleged that he discovered this reporting prior to the time when the limitations periods would have run. He filed his lawsuit in 2017. The earliest limitations period would have started running in 2015 on his claims, on his two-year slander and negligence claims. His deceptive trade practices had a four-year statute of limitations. So there is nothing in the record demonstrating when Mr. Kwan discovered or should have known of these claims, and there's certainly nothing on the face of this complaint. And with that, I will reserve my remaining time.
Okay, thank you. All right. We've got Mr. Richmond and Ms. Reyes. Are you splitting your time? Have you got an arrangement there, or is one of you taking the entire time?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Stephen Richmond for the respondent, Valley Federal Credit Union. I will be arguing on behalf of the respondent.
Okay.
I'd like to start off by noting that the record on appeal, along with the briefs, are over 400 pages in total. But to decide this case, this Court needs to only look at two pages themselves. That's the charging allegations in the 2013 lawsuit and the charging allegations in the case at bench. In the record on appeal, it starts the current lawsuit is at page 6, and then the 2013 lawsuit is at page 28. The reason these two single pages are important is that the allegations of the appellant are virtually identical. With a few minor exceptions, he makes the same allegations in the case at bench as he does in the 2013 lawsuit. Why is this important? This is important because the 2013 case has been resolved. It was settled, it was dismissed with prejudice, and a general release was given.
Let me ask you this. Going to his 2017 complaint for damages and looking just specifically at the slander allegation and his under claims paragraph number 2, he references the settlement agreement and indicated the agreement was to correct the negative reporting bank of the bank account, the Visa card, but then alleges that defendant continued to slander plaintiff's name and credit history by refusing to report this card accurately. That's something that occurred after the bankruptcy and after the first complaint, correct?
No, it's not. With all due respect, Your Honor,
okay.
The credit report and the complaint seems to exhibit a manifest misunderstanding of how credit reporting works. Credit reporting occurs one time, and that's when the account is closed and the action is taken. So all of this occurred in 2013, and that's admitted by the plaintiff earlier in his statement of facts. He indicates in paragraph 5 on page 2 of his complaint that the card was closed in 2013. Then he goes on in paragraph 11 to indicate that the bank is still continues to report the same report. So it is the same thing. Credit reports are issued once, and that is when the action is taken. Here, all of this action took place in 2013. That action is as
follows. Mr. Richmond, isn't that a fact question subject to discovery when, in fact, it was reported? And if
right.
Something was reported subsequently, wouldn't that potentially be a new claim?
No, with all due respect, it's not, because the complaint admits that this occurred in 2013. It doesn't say that a new report was filed. It says that the bank, Valley Federal, continues to report. So reports are done once when the act has occurred, and that is the closing
right.
of the account.
But isn't
and the
that
charger.
A factual determination? Who knows that? Do we have to take judicial notice of that?
Well, I think you take judicial notice of the fact that the complaint's identical and that those claims were released.
No, that's not identical. The card is being reported. It's continuing to be reported. But your argument is that, well, that's not our problem. That's credit reporting process. But we don't know that unless we take judicial notice. So I don't know how you say it's the same thing.
Yeah, I believe the court can take judicial notice of the fact that the allegations in both complaints are identical. And also the fact
except
that
for the part that they're not identical.
Right.
Because additional allegations are added.
The additional allegation is the word continue, which to me in common language means it's the same act. There's no allegation of a new credit report being issued. It just says it continues to report. And that is the same report that was filed in 2013. There's nothing new alleged in the complaint.
It's a settlement.
Possibly just as easily interpret that as they continue to report a little differently than what you're saying. If it's like my neighbor continues to make noise at night, that could be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that could be last month. I mean, the question is not whether this survives summary judgment. The question is, should it have survived a motion to dismiss?
That's right. I think analogizing this to a wall or a neighborly dispute is inappropriate because acts occur every day involving neighbors. Here, a credit report was issued in 2013. There are no subsequent credit reports issued.
How do we know that? like, based on the face of the well-pleaded complaint?
The complaint does not allege a new credit report. There's no date there. There is no reference to it. It's not attached. And I would think it is common knowledge that reports are issued once. An account is closed one time. When an account is closed and there is a charge-off, it's reported then. It's not reported every day and changed because nothing changes. Again, the account was closed in 2013. The bank reported the account was closed and that it had a charge-off. And that was it. The bank doesn't report anything else. It doesn't report the bankruptcy. That's picked up by the credit agencies. That's on public record.
Well, Mr. Richmond,
so
let me ask you
the
this.
For the plaintiff to argue that the bank reported his bankruptcy, that's just wrong. It's in the public record.
Mr. Richmond, if Mr. Klon calls and asks the client, which is what it seems to suggest here, or ask your client to fix it, like, look, this is still on the credit report and it's wrong, I want you to fix it, and you refuse, is that a new act, or you think that'd be covered by a previous action?
It's definitely covered by the prior action, and that is because the act has already occurred.
Well, no, it's a new act.
It's
I'm
no
calling
different
you,
than,
and I'm asking you to fix it, and you're saying no. I'm saying to your client, there's something wrong here in this record, fix it. How is that an old request?
I think it's no different than a breach of contract case or anything else where the act has occurred and the plaintiff says, you should cure this breach of contract. Otherwise, Mr. Klon could sue 50 years from now with the same thing, saying, I want you to fix it. These claims occurred in 2013 and were released and dismissed. So it's no different than any other lawsuit. Otherwise, there would be no statute of limitations if Mr. Klon could come 50 years from now and ask for it to be changed. The act occurred in 2013. It was settled. It was dismissed. And a release was given. And by the way, that release was given by the bankruptcy trustee, not Mr. Klon. So when counsel indicates that Mr. Klon didn't release this, it wasn't his claim to release. The bankruptcy trustee released it after the bankruptcy occurred. So it wasn't Mr. Klon that released it. It was the bankruptcy trustee's property. He released it well after the bankruptcy was filed.
Then can the bankruptcy trustee release Mr. Klon's claims in this way? Can he?
Yes.
Why does he have to be bound by this?
In bankruptcy, when someone files bankruptcy, the trustee inherits all non-exempt claims of the debtor. That's why the bankruptcy trustee entered the settlement. It was subject to court approval. The court approved it, and the bankruptcy trustee signed the release. It was his property. And frequently in bankruptcy cases, assets are sold or settled, whether they're cars, whether they're houses, or whether they're claims. And that's exactly what occurred here. The bankruptcy trustee settled the case. He was paid a nominal sum, and he signed the release. That release was signed after the bankruptcy was filed and is effective as of the date he signs it. It was the bankruptcy trustee's property and not that of Mr. Klon. I should also note that Mr. Klon did not object to the settlement, so he waived any rights. Also, speaking of waiving of any rights, there was argument today and in the brief on the statute of limitations issue. Mr. Klon did not brief that issue in his opposition to the motion to dismiss. So those claims have, that argument should be ignored because he
which
did
Which argument,
not
sorry, can you clarify which argument you're referring to now that you're saying is waived?
The statute of limitations argument.
Thank you.
That argument was waived because it's not in his opposition. It was not presented to Judge Jones at the trial court level, and it's inappropriate for counsel to put it in the briefs and to argue here that statute of limitations did not expire. That was unopposed and should be presumed to be the proper ruling. Ignoring the fact that the claims occurred in 2013 and this lawsuit was filed 4.5 years later, so they have been waived.
Mr. Richmond.
The same goes for any arguments involving the motion for attorney's fees. Mr. Klon did not oppose that motion, so the arguments in the brief relating to that should be ignored as well. So assuming the court agreed with everything in the briefs relating to the motion to dismiss, Mr. Klon did not argue anything about the statute of limitations. So
Mr.
he's been
Richmond?
Deemed to have admitted that.
Mr.
The facts are very clear.
Mr. Richmond.
In 2013, the lawsuit was filed.
Excuse me, sir. Can you hear Justice Stiglitz has a question for you. Is her mic not on?
Can you hear me?
I can barely hear you. Let me
increase
my volume a little
can
bit.
Can you hear me better now? Hello?
Can you repeat that? Yes, sure. I can hear you better.
Okay. Mr. Richmond, I'm looking at the court's order on the motion to dismiss. So why did the court dismiss? What reasoning am I to take from the court? What am I to understand from this order that says we grant a motion to dismiss? How does that help me resolve your case?
It helps to resolve it because the motion was granted on all grounds, and there were five grounds. Claim preclusion, issue preclusion, accord and satisfaction, general release, and statute of limitations. So the motion was made on five grounds, and it was granted on all five grounds.
And I'm to assume that just because it says defendant's motion is granted. That's it. I determine that that's their reasoning. You won on everything. Is that right?
Yes. That is my interpretation of what happened in court, and that is what the order says. And again,
did Judge Jones say something in court about his reasoning?
We had heated argument on some points, but his ruling was that he was going to grant the motion.
And my understanding is Mr. Klon wasn't present at the hearing, but of course he had filed an opposition. Is that correct?
That's correct. Judge Jones plays the devil's advocate. The hearing lasted several minutes. It was not open and shut. It was a bit heated on some points. And frankly, at some point, I thought he was going to deny the motion, but at the very end of the argument, he did indicate that it was granted. He submitted the order. So again, one of the arguments was statute of limitations. Mr. Klon did not brief it, so by law he's been deemed to have admitted the validity of that argument. So even if everything else is assumed to be correct, and then the arguments of Ms. Shanks, there was no briefing of the statute of limitations of art. And again, I urge the court to compare the charging allegations in both of the lawsuits. They're word for word identical. And everything is in the past tense. Except for in the new lawsuit, Mr. Klon mentions that Valley Federal continues to report. But it should be common knowledge that the report is made once, and that's it. That's the actionable wrongdoing. It's no different than saying a breach of contract is continuing because it hasn't been rectified. The breach occurred one time, and it's ongoing from that point because of the initial original act.
Would you agree that if a new report was made after settlement of the prior action, that would not be barred?
I would agree with that, but that's just not the way things work. Credit reports are issued once. And I would ask the court it's common knowledge. Reports are issued once and that's it. And Mr. Klon does not say otherwise.
Common knowledge to who? I mean, what in the record tells us that?
Well, unfortunately, it's not in the record because the allegations have changed on appeal that are not in the complaint. I mean, I could easily provide the court with the credit report and the date it occurred, but that's not alleged in the complaint. This all occurred on the appeal. If one looks at the complaint itself, everything is in the past tense, with the exception of the word continues, which I interpret to mean it's the same report that Valley Federal continues to keep in existence. It's not published every day.
But the fact that it says continues and the fact that you interpret is kind of what's giving me pause here about the propriety of granting a motion to dismiss.
Well, if one looks at that word and compares it to the rest of the complaint, every other word is in the past tense.
Yep.
So you can take all of those. If I may finish, you can take all of those words. They're all in the past tense. And if you look at the word continues in that light, to me it means there's one original sin that it That was done in 2013, and Valley Federal has failed to correct it.
Okay, and just one follow-up question. You're out of time, but you were emphatic in your statement that Mr. Klon never opposed the statute of limitation claim. Is that correct?
That's correct. That is in our
My understanding is that in his opposition to your motion to dismiss, he indicated he wasn't aware of the incorrect reporting period until March 2016, and that false reporting didn't begin until 2016. Is that incorrect?
He did say that, but that's the delayed discovery rule, which was not pleaded, and it's contradicted by the record. In 2013, his lawsuit in Montana alleges the credit reporting occurred at that time.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Shanks?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Klon, on page 112 of the record, raised the argument which this court just quoted back. He may not have used the magic word statute of limitations. He's a pro se plaintiff, but he did raise the argument that his claim was not time precluded. I'm not aware of any rule of law that requires you to affirmatively plead the discovery rule in Nevada either. Regarding the comments made about credit reporting, from the face of Mr. Klon's complaint, there's no indication that this reporting happened once. There's no indication that it was common knowledge. It would be possible that if this case did proceed to discovery, those facts would have come to light. But Mr. Klon, as his complaint was pled, was never allowed to reach that stage. And when you plead a complaint with pleading standards in Nevada, all factual allegations must be accepted as true. There's nothing in the record to indicate that this reporting had occurred previously. And as Mr. Klon points out in his reply brief, the use of his word continues, it's ambiguous. You know, Valley Federal Credit Union interprets that to mean the same reporting. In his opposition at pages 111 to 114 of the record, he argues it's new reporting and that it will continue in the future. And he is, again, a pro se plaintiff who is not the most artful when pleading. As the matter stands, there is simply nothing in the record to support a dismissal at the motion to dismiss phase. There is no evidence that this reporting was going on prior. Mr. Klon, although he raises the party's prior history, which is common in complaints against repeat, does not allege it previously occurred. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for the arguments and the briefs. Colleagues, do you have any additional question for either counsel?
No. I don't. Thank you.
All right. Then this matter will stand submitted, and this court will stand in recess until 11:30.
Thank you,
counsel.